This is Robert Davis. Today I'm coming to you from San Francisco. And yeah, normally that would not be noteworthy, but it is today because it's September, and September is Crazy Film Festival month. I guess it actually starts in August with Telluride, and then Venice, the big old European film festival. And as we've mentioned ad nauseum on this podcast, the second or the first and second weeks of September are the Toronto Film Festival, where I would normally be, except I don't know, I'm busy at the moment. When you're about to be a parent, you start getting advice from everywhere, and I can sort of see why. I've been a parent now for 2 weeks or so, and I already have a piece of advice. So get out a pad and pencil and jot this down. We got these videos for our kid. Supposed to be really good, these baby Eisenstein videos, and we haven't shown them to the kid yet. You know, she's still a little young, I think, for that, but I'm not sure we're going to, because I don't know, we looked at them and they seem really terrifying. I don't know if it's all the rapid editing or the, you know, I've only really seen this one that we have. Maybe there are better ones. The one we got has the baby carriage on these steps, and it starts rolling down, and soldiers' feet marching, and mother's screaming. Well, you don't hear the mother screaming, it's silent, but you see the screaming mother. I don't know, it just seems terrifying for a child. So I, you know, to each his own, but I can't recommend the baby Eisenstein videos. So I'm not in Toronto, I'm here in San Francisco, but not to worry, we do have a first-hand account. Our own J. Robert Parks is in Toronto, and we pinned him down not once, but twice, to ask him how things were going. And because of a freak eddy in the space-time continuum, you'll get to hear both of those conversations today, back-to-back, no waiting. Speaking of the space-time continuum, we mentioned last time that today we would be talking about a film from Taiwan called Three Times by Ho Xiao Shen. Well, we've had to change the schedule a little bit. We're going to talk about Toronto today instead. We'll come back to Ho Xiao Shen's film another time. But today we are going to talk about Ho Xiao Shen's latest film, which is called The Flight of the Red Balloon. It premiered in Toronto, and J. Robert saw it, and he'll tell us what he thinks. One other brief program note, although we're talking today about movies that have shown at Toronto, it also functions as a preview for the New York Film Festival, which has a lot of overlap. In fact, J. Robert and I are kind of tag-teaming this one. He's in Toronto. I'll be going to New York in October for part of the New York Film Festival, and so we'll compare notes on the parts that the festivals have in common and the films that are unique to each festival. In fact, you can read a review of the New York Film Festival's opening night film, written by the host of this program, at erotimag.com. The film is The Darjeeling Limited by Wes Anderson. As of today, this podcast is an enhanced podcast, which means if you're listening to it on your relatively recent iPod or iTunes or other compatible software, you should see little images associated with whatever we're talking about, and more importantly, there are chapter stops, so you can jump to the parts that are most interesting to you, or jump back to listen again to the parts that you enjoyed. Hello, J. Robert.
Hi, Rob. So, and by the way, congratulations on fatherhood.
Oh, thank you. So I'm going to ask you the question that people ask each other frequently during the festival. What have you seen?
I have seen about 20 films, so I'm halfway through the festival. And it's been a good festival so far. Two films, I think, particularly stand out for me. One is Roy Anderson's new film called You the Living. Anderson did several years ago a movie called Songs from the Second Floor, which I just think is fantastic. And You the Living is in the same vein and just as good. It's about, well, it's hard to say what it's about, but it's about the human condition and about how screwed up we are and how difficult it is to live. And yet through that all, we have hope. We have hope that things will get better. We have hope that we'll fall in love. We have hope that that even if this world isn't so great, that maybe the next one will be better. And his visual style is genuinely striking. A lot of long takes. Have you seen Songs from the Second Floor?
No, I haven't. But okay. I do remember when it was out. And I remember seeing some stills from it that looked really cool and made me want to see it. But for some reason, I just never got around to it. But this gives me another excuse to check it out.
Yeah, it's you know, his visual style is a lot of long takes. usually static long takes. They're not much camera movement. When there is camera movement, it's sort of striking because of its relatively rareness. But in this movie, the colors are washed out in I think interesting ways, and it fits with his overall thematic content. But the movie is also genuinely funny, in particular the first 20 minutes. I was happy there were subtitles because the crowd was laughing so hard we missed all of the dialogue, and we just if we had been an English language film, we would have missed everything because there are these almost Tati-like moments of visual comedy where he sort of uses the space to create these great moments of humor. And then as the film goes on, it becomes a little bit less humorous and more mournful, I think, is the word I'd use.
And it's the film's called, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, it's called You the Living,
Yeah.
and it's from a quote by Goethe, and I don't actually have the quote in front of me, but it's about how lucky you are to be alive because the alternative isn't so great. that's of course a horribly paraphrased version, but it's yeah, so the film is it's not going to be for all tastes, and particularly if you didn't like Songs from the Second Floor, I'm not sure it'd be worth the time because it's so similar. But it's right in my wheelhouse. It's the sort of thing I really like.
What else have you seen?
The other masterpiece I've seen, I saw yesterday, and I'm not alone in this, and that's the film that won the Palme d'Or this year at Cannes, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, the Romanian film, which is just awesome. It's very, where You the Living is very stylized, 4 months is very straightforward. It's a movie. I'm not going to say too much because I think the less you know, the more powerful it becomes. But it's about two young women who are college students who have something they have to accomplish. And the movie just follows them over the course of the day as they try to accomplish that. And the lead actress is just incredible. She gives a great performance. And the movie is about trust and responsibility and how we interact with our with the people around us. It reminds me a little bit of the Dardenne brothers in that it's pretty stripped down, particularly in its visual style, although I think it's even less showy than they are. It tends to be static, long takes, but yet the conversations that people are having, or sometimes not having, are riveting. I can't remember a story and dialogue that was so powerful and that I just couldn't take my eyes off the screen. So that's just a great film, and that's the sort of film that I can recommend to almost anyone who's a fan of drama. You know, it's a Romanian movie and firmly within the growing tradition of Romanian film, but
Yeah, we've
it's
talked on this podcast before
yeah.
about how Romanian film is in this sort of a hot spot at the moment with the death of Mr. Lazarescu a couple of years ago, and then
Yep.
this one, which this one's title is hard to remember, but it's 4-3-2, 4 months,
Correct.
3 weeks, 2 days, and it
Yep.
won the Palme d'Or at Cannes this year. So I've been looking forward to seeing it, and I'm glad to hear that you agree that it's great.
Oh yeah, and everyone does. You know, there's no division on this one, and so I think you're gonna love it. And it's the sort of movie that I can recommend to anyone who's not afraid of subtitles, because it's really powerful.
All right, two good recommendations, You the Living and the 4 months movie from Romania. What else?
It's been a good festival. There's only one film that I didn't much care for, which I saw last night, and that's Léonie Scherfig's new movie, Just Like Home. She's a Danish director who did Italian for Beginners and Wilbur Wants to Kill Himself.
Okay.
And this film just didn't do as much for me. It's kind of simple, kind of crowd pleasing, kind of banal. But otherwise, everything I've seen has been really interesting. I saw Zhiyu Zhenke's new documentary, Useless.
Yeah.
He's the guy who did Still Life and Dong last year, although most people may have heard of him from the movie The World that he did a few years ago.
Right.
This is a documentary about the clothing industry in China, and it focuses particularly on one fashion designer, clothing store operator, who could be a fashion designer anywhere in the world. I mean, she talks like, you know, someone in Paris or New York or Milan. And then But and so her approach contrasts then with the she's kind of in the middle of the film, and the first part of the movie is about it just focuses on kind of factories where clothes are made, and then the last part of the film goes to this kind of coal mining town and looks at local tailors or people who used to be tailors and now are miners, and that for me was the third segment was the most interesting of the three. It's the one that sort of gets closest to what he was doing in Dong, where he's sort of examining through individual people how lives have been changed and transformed, particularly in China's new economy. I like the film a lot. It's short. It's 70 minutes, and it feels really short. It feels like, wow, I wish this was an hour longer. And I don't mean that in a good way. I don't mean it like leaves you wanting more. It's like, I'm not sure we've seen as much as we should see to really get a sense of what's going on. But you know, he's just a master of editing, and he's a master of being able to construct ideas through images. And so that I liked a lot, and it's well worth your time when it comes to San Francisco.
And was that shot on digital video like his last couple of movies?
It is, and it's not quite as striking as Still Life in particular. It has the same visual feel as the DV does and or as the digital video does in Still Life, but it's interesting, but it's not quite the same. I think sort of going inside factories doesn't have exactly the same effect as, you know, watching buildings being
The
destroyed.
Three Gorges, yeah.
Yeah. So no, I think the power of the film comes more from the juxtaposition of images, in particular the contrast between this woman and the factories that we see before her and the tailors and miners that we see after her. But I like that. It's definitely worthwhile, even if it's not quite as strong as I'd hoped.
Now, there were a couple of my favorite filmmakers who had movies at Toronto this year that I think you've already seen. One of them is Hou Hsiao-hsien from Taiwan.
Yes, and I like it. This is a Flight of the Red Balloon or Voyage of the Red Balloon. I'm not going to try to pronounce the French title; that'd just embarrass me. But it's in French, and it stars Juliette Binoche, and as this she's a woman who
Which this so this alone is unusual for Hou Hsiao-hsien, who shoots things in
That's right.
Taiwan. So not only is it in French, and I assume maybe shot in Paris or France. I don't.
Yes, that's right, and in a way, it's a little bit of a love song to Paris. You know, there's various shots of you know familiar landmarks as well as you know city streets, and so it's a little bit like Paris, Je T'aime last year in its way of trying to capture the city,
And it.
although more successful, I think. Sorry.
And it stars an Oscar-winning actress, which is the other thing that's unusual about this movie. Anyway, so go ahead. You said
No, sorry. Yeah, and she's great. She gives this wild, vibrant performance as a puppet theater director. You know, kind of a little bit more not for kids, but actually for adults. But the main, she's only. It's interesting, and she's obviously the big star of the film. But her character is only one of many, and sort of the main character, if you could call her that, is basically a stand-in for the director. It's this young Chinese woman who's studying film in Paris and who becomes a nanny to Juliette Binoche's son. And so many of the scenes in the movie just involve this nanny and the little boy wandering around Paris, as they're followed by a red balloon. The movie is a homage to the, you know, the famous French short from the 50s. Although I haven't seen the short film, and so I can't talk exactly about how it's a tribute to that movie or how they compare. I think you're going to like the film more than I do, Rob, just because I think you like Ho's films, more recent work, a lot more than I do. I like the film, and you know, he's just, again, he's doing unbelievable things with the light, both indoor and outdoor light, and it's a very sentimental and nicely sentimental film, and so I enjoy that. But I wasn't blown away by it. Our friends Darren and Girish loved it. And so maybe that's a good sign for you. But for me, I merely liked it. Part of my problem is that there is no real plot to the movie. And not that I need a plot, but it's a rather traditional film, except that it has no story. It's just a series of scenes. And the scenes sort of have things to do with each other, but not quite. And so therefore it relies much more on character. And the Juliette Binoche character is really interesting, and her little boy is a lot of fun. But the Chinese nanny is really a flat character. There's no backstory to her, and she doesn't really do anything in the movie except kind of be this stand-in. And so I found that a bit frustrating. And so therefore the movie for me is not without its flaws.
Well, it's I did like Three Times, his previous movie, but the movie before that, Café Lumière, I was surprisingly lukewarm about when I saw it the first time, and other people seemed to really like it, and it was the first time I'd had that reaction to one of his movies, so I wasn't sure if it was just me, but then I saw it again, sort of knowing that it was a smaller, simpler movie, and really enjoyed it, and so I don't know, maybe my sense of Flight of the Red Balloon is that might be a good idea for me to go in with that in mind when I see it eventually.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this film reminds me of Café Lumière in the way it's constructed and also in its approach to light. Like there's a few scenes in Red Balloon that are almost photographs from Café Lumière, particularly like light pouring through the window with clothes in it. So yeah, it is very similar to that film, I think, in its tone. I saw this other movie called Jellyfish, which is an Israeli film, and is really nice. I think you'd like it a lot, Rob. It's a quiet film. Several characters in this Israeli city sort of interacting in various ways. The film is very poetic, very concerned with visual metaphor and visual symbols, and it's just a nice movie. There's sort of a tone of sadness about it, but a lot of humor, and it's nothing particularly profound, but it's a very nice film. So I was happy I was able to get a chance to see that one. Oh, another movie I really liked is a movie called Happiness, which was from Korea. And it's a movie that if you had English actors or American actors, you could have made it in the 50s. It's sort of constructed like a classic Hollywood film where this guy, probably around 30 years old, has partied so hard in his 20s that he actually has cirrhosis of the liver. And so he checks himself into, an alternative clinic for people with life-threatening diseases. And there he meets a young woman who has cystic fibrosis. And within the first 15 minutes of the movie, you know that this is going to be a love story and that it's also going to be a weepy. And yet even though it follows that path and you know that path, the two leads are so winning, and the movie is so nicely constructed with the fun secondary characters that I just had a great time. I thought it was fantastic.
What was that called again?
It's called Happiness.
Okay.
And I wouldn't be surprised if that gets an American release because it's pretty accessible. I mean, it really does feel like a 50s film.
So you said you're halfway through the festival. What do you have coming up in the second half?
I've got Silent Light today. I've also got the Gus Van Sant, which I'm excited about, Paranoid Park, which got good reviews at Cannes. Tomorrow, a film that I know you and I are both interested in, the new Werner Herzog documentary, Encounters at the End of the World, which is about Antarctica and the people who work there. I have the new Sakharov film, Alexandra, which has gotten great reviews, so I'm excited about that.
And do you like his movies?
I do. I do typically. I think Russian Ark is really good. We saw The Sun together, did we see it together, Robert?
Yes.
Or did we just, and I thought that was very strong. I've seen a couple of his Elegy films, which are smaller films he made, I think, in the 90s, and those are really, really quiet and slow, but really nice. So, yeah, I like his films a lot, so I'm excited about this one. Have you seen a lot of his work? Do you like it?
No, I've only seen the two that you first mentioned. Russian Ark, which I thought was interesting as an experiment, but otherwise I don't think I want to see it much more. The Sun, which S-U-N, The Sun, about Emperor Hirohito and the final days of World War II was really cool. I liked that movie a lot.
Yeah.
And so seeing that has made me interested in seeing a lot more of his stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to Alexandra also.
Speaking of Russian film, and I know we've got to wrap the conversation up fairly soon, but one of the better films I've already seen is a movie called The Banishment, made by the same director who did The Return a few years ago. And I don't know if you had seen that earlier film. That was his debut.
I didn't see it. I saw the trailer for that, and it said that, there's a new Tarkovsky, which is what everyone says when there's a Russian director that people like, and
Well,
it's never
and
true.
the Tarkovsky influences are clear and acknowledged. And this movie is, I think, just as good. He's dealing in a lot of Christian symbolism, which, some people will groove on, some people won't. But his painterly compositions are maybe the best cinematography I've seen at the festival so far. And I've seen a lot of great cinematography this year. So the movie is just a drama about a marriage. Played out at a kind of a summer house in the country, and but it's a very powerful film with great acting. The actor won the Best Actor prize at Cannes, and the movie I think is very worthwhile. So, other things I'm looking forward to seeing tomorrow night. Or no, tonight. It's weird, Rob. You know this, but the days at Toronto just sort of blur together, and I have to ask myself, is today Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday? I can't remember. But I think actually tonight I have a ticket for Dr. Plunk, which is a movie by Ralph Deayer, who did Ten Canoes.
Yeah, and the
So,
tracker.
yeah, that's right, and The Tracker, that's right, Australian director. Well, this film apparently is something completely different. It's a silent comedy, and so I thought that would be a fun. When we're at Toronto, we tend to see a lot of heavy dramas, and so if I see a comedy that actually looks like it could be good, I try to snap it up because it's just nice to have a change of pace. So I'm looking forward to that tonight. But no, there's a lot of really great stuff I'm still excited about, although it's been a strong festival so far. So
All
we all
right,
miss you
great.
though.
Well,
Yeah,
I
it feels
wish
a
I was
little empty
there.
without Rob Davis in the seat next
Well, that's
to
good to hear.
me.
And I'm. It feels weird being on the outside, but it's helping me choose the movies I'm going to see over the next month or so.
Yeah, because you're going to be going to New York,
That's right. Yeah.
and for their festival, and yeah, you'll have a chance to catch up with some of these, and the Mill Valley Film Festival is coming up shortly, right?
That's in October, also. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure some of these movies will make it there, and then, well, that's the great thing about San Francisco. Everything will, well, not everything, but most things that are worthwhile will eventually make their way to your neck of the woods.
Yep. But you're seeing it first, J. Robert, and I hope that we will check in the second half at some point to see
Yeah.
what else is good.
No, that sounds great. So, thanks, Rob.
All right, talk to you then.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Excuse me. Excuse me. I interrupt to ask you to join me in the future, won't you? Whoa. Whoa.
Oh.
Hello, J. Robert.
Hey, Rob, how are you?
Good. So, last time I spoke with you, the festival was about half over, and now you're back in Chicago, I believe.
I am. I got back this afternoon. It's Sunday evening, and so I'm still a little bit weary, not only from traveling, but just I remember something you said last year that, you get to the end of the festival and you kind of ask, you say to yourself, "I wish there were more movies." Thank God there are no more movies.
Yeah.
It
Yes.
is. It's a tiring experience, and not just because you're watching 40 films in a week and a half, but you're thinking about movies so much. You're having conversations about movies, and people are asking you what you think, and you're having really interesting discussions about them, and but you're also meeting new people, in line or in dinner, and so it's just a very involving experience. And then for me, I'm trying to blog while I'm in Toronto because I don't have quite as much time when I get back. And so, most of my waking free moments are spent writing or thinking about movies. And so when you get back, you're like, "Whoo, that was intense. It was a good but long week and a half."
Yeah, I definitely remember the times that I've been there, a number of late night diner meals with two or three other people, but basically just zoned out, bleary eyed, swallowing some eggs and then heading back to hit the hay. But well, before we get to the Guy Madden, which it sounds like was your last film, let's rewind to I believe when we spoke it was Monday, and the last movie we talked about, or one of the last, was 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, which you
What a great
liked a
film.
lot.
Yeah, I sure did. And actually, that's probably my favorite favorite film of the festival, although the first film I saw after we talked, which was Silent Light, gives it close competition. Carlos Regadas, who I know that you really liked his last film, Battle in Heaven, which I did not like.
Let me set the scene for this, actually, because as people who listen to this know, you and I have very similar taste in movies, and so when you've seen something and recommend it to me, then I'm interested in seeing it, and vice versa.
Yep.
But there are, you know, half a dozen people who are the same way. If people recommend something, I'm interested. And every once in a while, there are these conflicts where someone highly recommended that Carlos Regadas' second movie to me. It's called Battle in Heaven. And then you saw it and hated it. And so I was like, wow, these are two people who I very often agree with who are opposite ends of the spectrum. And I ended up seeing it. I actually ended up liking it a lot. But it's a very provocative and controversial movie. It's very graphic and it's thought-provoking, but a lot of people just don't like it. And for very legitimate reasons, as you've pointed out. But I ended up talking to Regadas for a while, not at Toronto, but later at Sundance when I caught up with him again, and felt like he's a fairly new filmmaker, but that he's really serious about what he's doing. And so I've been really looking forward to this next movie, and I'm very interested to hear that you liked it. Silent Light, it's called.
Yeah, I do. And I remember the word out of Cannes was that people who didn't like Battle in Heaven seemed to really like this one, whereas people who were really in love with Battle in Heaven liked it, but maybe not quite as much. And Darren Hughes, who is in that latter camp, said something interesting afterwards, several days afterwards. He goes, I was sort of disappointed that he didn't go back to his bag of tricks because I really like that bag of tricks. It's not as provocative, particularly with regards to sex. It's more controlled. I would argue that it's a more mature work, but I think that's kind of a loaded term, so I'd be careful about how I use that word. It's a movie about, it's set in Mexico, but it's about this Mennonite family, German Mennonite family, and a large family, actually, many kids. And we learn early on in the film that the husband, who's apparently a very upstanding man, is having an affair. But he's told his wife that he's having an affair. And it's been going on for a couple of years. And so he's feeling like he needs to make a choice. This isn't something he wants. He feels almost like he's destined to have this affair. And so the movie is a relatively simple story. And there are long periods where not much happens, and those periods are sometimes unbelievably beautiful. There's a scene in which the family is swimming and bathing in a river, and it's just awe-inspiringly beautiful. The opening shot is, which I'm sure you'll read about if you read about the film, is it starts off with a shot at night of the stars, and then the camera moves and pans to a very, very faint glimpse of light at dawn. And suddenly, not suddenly, but over the course of probably several minutes, the light gets brighter and brighter. And you realize that there are these two huge trees, and you see them sort of silhouetted against the sky as the sun comes up over the mountains, or over the hills, I should say. And it's just awesome. It's a beautiful shot. Hmm. And the whole movie is filled with these incredible sequences. And so it's a great film. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of Tarkovsky in it. There's a lot of references to Dreyer. So Regadas is certainly kind of harkening back to kind of old European masters. But there's also, if you're going to sort of reference Tarkovsky and Dreyer, it sort of makes sense that you're going to have a heavily spiritual aspect to the film, and that's important too. Although what he does with it, I think, is very fascinating. We can talk about it at length once you've seen the movie, but it's really fantastic, and I loved it. And other people who were more fans of Battle in Heaven still like this one, but maybe not quite as much as those of us who didn't like Battle in Heaven. Hmm. And are now kind of thrilled at this new direction. So I'll be curious what you think when you see it.
Yeah, let's touch base again in October. I'll be at the New York Film Festival, and I'll see it there.
Have you already planned out your schedule for New York?
I have, yeah. So that's one of the movies that's definitely in there. And another one that's in there is Paranoid Park, the new Gus Van Sant movie, which I think you also saw.
I did and liked. Not as much as some people did. It's very much like Elephant in that it's focusing on a group of teenagers and played by non-professional actors, but it's much more of a mood piece than sort of a plot-driven story. The plot as it is about this boy in high school who loves to skateboard, and so he and his friend decide that they're going to go to Paranoid Park, which is kind of the big radical skate park where, you know, all the cool kids hang out, and it's a little bit scary and intimidating. And then something happens, and I won't say what happens because it's not quite clear exactly what has happened in the movie, at least until the end of the film. And the movie is told in fragments, and those fragments aren't always linearly constructed. So you're going forward in time, you're going back in time. But it's a pretty provocative portrait of this one high school boy. And so I found that interesting, and I liked it. And Christopher Doyle does the cinematography, and he's just awesome. he's one of the greatest cinematographers in the world.
Yeah, he is.
And so there's these really dreamy shots of skateboarders flying through the air, and I could have watched that for a half hour.
Now, are you someone who likes his recent movies, Jerry, Elephant, as you mentioned, and Last Days?
I am. And I like this one about equally well. I don't love any of those movies, but I like them all, and I find them interesting and worth thinking about. I particularly like Last Days just because there the mood piece is I just found it particularly interesting. Not that I was a big Kurt Cobain or Nirvana fan earlier in life, but I found that one especially good. Paranoid Park reminds me a lot of Elephant without the violence. Although there is, I should warn potential viewers that there is one short but really gruesome scene. And so if sort of blood and gore sort of even in small doses turns you off, that might be worth avoiding because it is it's surprising and then it's gross. I read a couple bloggers or talked with a couple people at Toronto who kind of were really put off by the film because of that. It didn't do that to me, but I could see how it could.
Well, I like his recent movies too, and I especially like them sort of in theory. The guy who made Good Will Hunting, you know, now making these
yeah.
very strange, very very even non-narrative movies in the case of Jerry,
yep.
which is pretty interesting. But also, I don't think it is just in theory because I've enjoyed the experience of watching them. Something about that hypnotic. People have compared them to Bélatar, who also had a film in Toronto we talked about earlier,
right.
which you were actually disappointed in this year. But he just this the sort of hypnotic style of following characters around, and I don't know, I like it a lot. So I'm looking forward to this one too.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. I mean, it's very much in the vein of what he's been doing recently, and in that sense, I liked it about the same as I have many of the other ones.
Now, somebody who is cranking out about a movie a year, sometimes more, is Werner Herzog, who has a documentary in this year's festival.
Yeah, Encounters at the End of the World. I was blogging about this just last night, and I sort of said that, you know, anytime Herzog comes out with a documentary, it's reason to celebrate. He is one of my favorite directors working right now. He did Grizzly Man a couple years ago, which I think is just a brilliant, brilliant film. But even, I know you and I have talked about, not in the podcast, but at other conversations, about his earlier documentaries, which are really interesting and provocative. This one is about his trip to Antarctica. And so it's another movie about testing one's limits and you know, what is the limit of the human experience. It's also very clearly a response to March of the Penguins.
Really?
Which if you've, you know, anyone who's seen Grizzly Man will know that Werner Herzog does not believe in animal love. He doesn't believe in, you know, nature being, you know, a wonderful, happy, fuzzy place.
Yeah.
And so he goes to...
He believes the natural state is that it will murder us.
Yes. Well, the funny thing is, I mean, this comes up on more than one occasion in this documentary. There's one really funny scene where he's interviewing this biologist who does a lot of work in Antarctica. And the biologist, you know, says that he believes that animals evolved to walk out of the ocean onto land because the ocean was such a horrible place to live. You know, so they were desperate to get out of there. And then Herzog interviews this guy who actually studies penguins in Antarctica, and he asks these really funny questions, you know, like, is it true that there are gay penguins? And, you know, could penguins go insane? and I'm thinking, why is he asking about insane penguins? Well, then immediately after that, he does this, he has this footage of this one penguin that instead of marching towards the sea or marching back towards the nesting area, is literally marching out into the middle of nowhere. And so it gives Herzog this chance to, you know, sort of have this long discourse about the possibility of animals going insane. It's fantastic. You know, because it's so Herzog and his venom and sort of irritation with movies like March of the Penguins is so evident. It was fun. I found it a great time.
That does sound fun.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead and drop.
I was just going to say, he made a movie just before Rescue Dawn, which is probably still in theaters somewhere, called The Wild Blue Yonder,
yeah.
Which is mostly found footage. It's a much smaller movie than most of the things he's done recently. You know, he clearly assembled it kind of quickly, but it's really beautiful, just these neat... well, one of the segments is underneath the ice shelf in Antarctica, this great footage. I think he said that he wanted to return to Antarctica for his next film, and I wasn't sure if it was going to be for another one of these sort of small found footage things or it was going to be something more substantial, and it sounds like it's probably more substantial.
It is, although there's similar footage to that in this one. He has a friend who dives,
yeah.
And so we see some of that footage, and it's just spectacular. It's really, really beautiful. And not all of it is about nature. There's a lot of interviews with the people who come to Antarctica. And again, they're very much kindred souls with Herzog. There are people who travel, people who are bored with life, and so they want to try something new. And so there are these wonderful conversations about, you know, where they've been and how they ended up here. It's not quite as good a movie, I think, as Grizzly Man, because it's a bit more diffuse. There's like five different places he goes, and they don't all quite tie together, and so it doesn't have the thematic consistency of some of his other documentaries, but I still enjoyed it thoroughly.
Hmm. Well, another movie that you saw, but I don't think we talked about last time, was Secret Sunshine.
Hmm. Yeah, and I'm not sure I want to talk too much about this today either. In part because I think it'd be a really great discussion once you've had a chance to see it, and in part because I'm still processing it. It's a movie. I can just sort of describe it briefly, not to just drop the subject. But a woman and her young son moved to this place where her husband grew up. And we find out pretty early on in the film that the husband died in an accident recently, and so this is kind of a way of grieving, maybe a way of paying tribute to her husband. But when she gets there, another tragedy strikes her. I mentioned in my blog it's the sort of tragedy that happens much more in movies than in real life. And I think that was part of my problem with the film. Almost everyone I know and respect loves this movie. So the fact that I'm somewhat ambivalent about it is I'm very much the minority position. But I found myself distanced from the material at several points in the story. And therefore, I never quite grasped onto it, but it's definitely an interesting film. As we sort of follow this woman, she goes through this tragedy or this second tragedy, and out of the result of that, she converts to Christianity. And then something else happens, and I won't spoil the last half of the film at all. But again, there's shifts in her emotional state. And so the movie is very much a melodrama in the sense of heightened emotion. I was joking with someone at Toronto that, you know, one thing I learned from the films I saw was that vomiting is the universal symbol of emotional distress. I don't know how much vomiting I saw at TIFF, but it was a lot. And so sometimes I wasn't quite riding along with the journey of this woman. But I must say this about Secret Sunshine is it has one of the most interesting secondary characters I saw at the festival. There's this man named Mr. Kim. And early on in the movie, he's kind of an irritating presence in that he's clearly trying to romantically pursue this woman and doing it very clumsily. And after a while, you get a little bit tired of him. But then as time goes on, he turns into not that he shifts his character, but his character deepens in ways that make what happened at the beginning of the film much more interesting. And so friends and I were talking about how much we liked this character, and the actor who plays him is just fantastic. And so that was, for all of my ambivalence about the film, I do particularly like this one character. But we can talk more once you've seen it, because my guess is you'll like it more than I did, and then the discussion will be a lot more productive.
Yeah, let's talk about it then. The reason I asked about it is because Lee Chang-dong, the director who made Secret Sunshine, had a movie a few years ago called Oasis that really knocked me out. It was like 6 or 7 years ago, and it's so melodramatic that to describe it on paper sounds almost ridiculous, but he handled it so deftly that it's really moving. It's about a woman with cerebral palsy and a sort of romance that develops. And it's also the first place I ever saw Moon So-ri, who is now a well-known South Korean actress, maybe, you know, one of the best, I guess. Yes. I've seen her in a few things. She's always good, but that movie in particular was great. They also made a movie called Peppermint Candy that I haven't seen, but I know is really highly regarded. Have you seen that?
No, I've seen Oasis and completely agree with your assessment, but I've never seen Peppermint Candy. And Secret Sunshine is in the same vein as Oasis, although different. So.
Okay. Well, you know, the reason it's been so long since he has made a movie, 5 or 6 years, he was serving in the government. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
He was like Minister of Art and Culture or something in the South Korean government.
Oh, can we credit him for all the good Korean films that have come out? I mean, you know, it's I'm trying to think of how many Korean films I saw here this festival. At least 2 and maybe 3, but most I've seen in the last few years have been really strong.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that he helped push forward, or if you just happened to be there at the same time, I don't know. There's a movie on your schedule called The Pope's Toilet. I don't know if you want to talk about this, but that's a great title.
It is a great title. I saw several films in the festival that was sort of like The Pope's Toilet, where I was taking a chance on films. Like, that one is from Uruguay. I saw a film from Bangladesh, which apparently was the very first film from Bangladesh ever shown in the Toronto Film Festival.
Wow.
I saw a movie that took place in kind of a remote part of Mexico. And I saw a film about street kids on the streets of Hungary. And so these four films, The Pope's Toilet is the one from Uruguay, On the Wings of Dreams is from Bangladesh, Iska's Journey is the Hungarian film, and Cochochi is the Mexican film. All these films were small little movies by either first-time directors or relatively unknown directors. And they're the sorts of things that I always like to try at Toronto, just to, you know, you don't want to see just big auteur after big auteur. It's nice to take a chance on first-time directors. But in almost every case, the films were somewhat disappointing. Not that they were bad, although the one from Bangladesh is not terribly good. But they're somewhat limited by their low budget, and their stories are unfortunately conventional. The Pope's Toilet is based on a true situation, not a true story, but a true situation, in which the Pope was coming to speak at this relatively remote Uruguayan town. And this is Pope John Paul II. And so there was a strong belief in the town that thousands and thousands and thousands of people were going to come, not only from Uruguay, but across the border from Brazil. And so everyone in the town decides that this is their golden opportunity to make good money. And so they're going to bake food or they're going to do a variety of things. Well, this one guy gets the idea of, well, if they're going to eat a lot of food, they're going to need to use the bathroom. And so he builds a fancy bathroom instead of an ugly outhouse. And he's going to charge people for the privilege. And that is maybe a good setup, except that I don't know if there's ever been a movie, but particularly not, you know, sort of an independent foreign film in which a get-rich scheme works. And so therefore, it's pretty clear from, you know, halfway through how this movie is going to end, which is unfortunate because the first half of the movie is really fun because it sets up this this town, and the main character is this husband, and he's a smuggler is what he is. He rides his bicycle with several other guys across the border to Brazil, gets things, and brings them back into the country and tries to avoid the customs inspector. But the relationships between the various smugglers and also between this man and his wife and his teenage daughter are really great. And so I was really enjoying the portrait of this place and getting a sense of these people. But once the story kicks in the second half, you know, and it's all about, you know, the difficulties of building this bathroom and how he's going to get the money to build it and whether his wife will give him the money or not, I just didn't find that quite as interesting. And that was kind of true of a lot of the other films, where the portrait of the place was kind of interesting, but then the story itself was a little bit too simple.
Well, let me ask you this. Does the Pope's toilet feature vomiting?
Let me think. Because I wouldn't be surprised if it does. But no, I don't think that one does feature vomiting.
Okay. I just wanted to mark my scorecard here.
Yes. You know, Iska's Journey, though, I think that one has vomiting.
Did you see, you mentioned wanting to see a few movies by unknown or new filmmakers. Yeah. Did you see anything that you liked this year that was by someone you hadn't seen anything by before?
Yeah, there was. But let me preface it by saying this. One of the things that a lot of us were talking about at the festival was that there were very few big surprises this year. In other words, the films that a lot of people liked were ones that either had gotten great reviews at Cannes or great reviews at Venice, or were just by very established auteurs. Whereas a lot of the films that we were taking chances on turned out to be okay, decent, but rarely more than that. The movie, there were two movies that I saw in the last half of the festival, though, that were by directors I wasn't familiar with. One was called The Sun Also Rises, which is a Chinese film. And it was nice because it was a very different kind of Chinese film. It's much more about, of all things, Jungian archetypes than sort of plot and narrative. It's broken up into four segments, and the first three segments are set in 1976 in China, which is right after the death of Mao. And while that doesn't have anything to do with the story, I think that context is helpful, because the first segment is about this, probably 18, 19-year-old boy whose mother seems to be going crazy. And yet she's going crazy in ways that feel much more like a dream than reality. And the editing is really rapid fire editing, you know, so you've got a cut coming every 3/4 of a second or a second. Not that it's confusing. It's not like a Michael Bay film, but it's trying to create this atmosphere of a little bit of lunacy or craziness. And so suddenly the mother is up in the top of a tree, you know, or suddenly this this piece of grass floats out into the river for no apparent reason. You see this these clothes floating down the river. And so you have all these, you know, it really invites a psychoanalytic reading. I'm not doing it quite justice because it's kind of bizarre. As the movie goes on, it becomes more plot-driven and less symbolic, I guess. But it's I enjoyed it a lot. It was a lot of fun. It was thought-provoking. I don't have any idea what it really means. I don't really understand how it fits into Chinese history, although I know that it does. It clearly is about the cultural evolution and the Great Leap Forward and you know, sort of a whole country going insane, I think. But I would have to see it again, and I'd really like to see it again. I think it would appreciate on second viewing. There's one scene, I can kind of describe this, and this will give you a sense of the movie. In the second segment of the film, it shifts to this other character, a man probably in his 30s. And he's a teacher, and the students are all, or at least the students we see, are all women who appear to be dressed up in nurses' uniforms, very sexy nurses' uniform. And they are kneading dough, bread dough. The phone rings. One of them goes to answer the phone, listens for about 3 seconds, screams, and then yells, "You pervert," and hangs up. Phone rings again. The next student goes, same reaction. And we see this 5 times. Each time the women come back, they laugh, and they go back to kneading their dough in what can only be described as sexy ways. So, I mean, you can just go crazy with this, not from a story angle, but from a psychoanalytic angle. And so I really enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed it more than others, but I just thought it was fun.
Is the title a conscious reference to Hemingway, or is it just a funny translation?
I don't know. It has to do with the film. The film closes with the sun rising. And I think I don't know if it is actually a conscious reference to Hemingway. I hadn't thought of that. Now that you mention it. To me, I had interpreted it in part as the rising of China in a post-Mao world or in a post-Cultural Revolution world. But I think the movie can work on a whole bunch of levels. It's very smart, and clearly the director is trying to do a lot of things. Whether that all comes together, I'm not sure. Some friends who also saw it weren't quite as enthusiastic. They thought it's a bit too scattershot. I agree that it's scattershot, but I enjoyed it anyway, and almost in part because of that.
It wasn't a midnight movie, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
No, it was actually for me, it was a 9 a.m. movie. But it was a fun way to start the day.
The midnight movies sometimes tend to be these kind of zany, crazy, visually nutty movies. Okay, so it looks like on Saturday you ended the fest with two films by two well-known filmmakers. One is Alexandra.
Yes, by Alexander Zelkov. And that was strong. It feels a little bit like The Sun, his earlier film, which you and I saw in Toronto a couple of years ago. And it's not similar in content or themes, but it's similar in the way it's shot. It's kind of this faded browns and this really beautiful pale lighting. But it's about this woman, a grandmother, who goes to a Russian army base in Chechnya to visit her grandson. And it's just kind of a simple story of her kind of reconnecting with her grandson, but that's only a small part of the film. It's also how it's kind of her watching all these other soldiers and seeing how they are. And then at one point in time, she leaves the base and heads into this Chechenian market and meets an older woman her own age, but who's not Russian. And it's a simple story, and some people faulted the film for that, but I thought it was really beautiful. And I thought it was pretty clear that the film is trying to say something about the Russian military presence in Chechnya and what that does, and also how war affects soldiers and what it means to be a soldier. And the woman who plays Alexandra is apparently a very famous opera singer in Russia, and she's great. She has great screen presence. She's really just a fantastic actress with great charisma. And so she carries the film and carries it very well. I liked it a lot.
And the other film by a well-known filmmaker that you saw on Saturday is the movie that Guy Madden told me in the first episode of this podcast that he hoped would jumpstart Winnipeg tourism.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
I listened to that podcast, but I don't remember that part.
It's the very end.
Oh, man, that's funny. My Winnipeg was just a perfect way to end the festival. It was not only was it sort of a film about Canada, and so therefore that's a nice way to end the Toronto Film Festival, but it was just absolutely hilarious. It's a film done somewhat in Madden style, in that it's black and white cinematography, although it looks more like cinematography from the 50s and 60s, which is appropriate because that's a lot of what he's talking about in the film. So it doesn't have all the flickering that some of his more silent influenced works do. But it's a film about it's a film about escaping from Winnipeg, but it's also, it's really a meditation on memory and growing up. And so it's all about his parents and about the Winnipeg hockey teams, which, have always been a theme in a lot of his work. And it's about snow and it's about winter. And it's just random observations about Winnipeg that I don't really know if it adds up to anything. But I laughed pretty much from beginning to end. You know, it's hard. We were walking back from the theater back to the hotel last night, and all we were doing was just quoting our favorite lines from the movie, you know, almost like some people do with The Simpsons. But if I were to share them with you now, they would make no sense at all. None. But if you've seen the movie, they're just priceless, and you know, it's great. Particularly if you've seen some of Madden's other films, because there are fun correlations between them. But even if you're not, it's maybe a good place to start with Madden. I should say this, I didn't say this before, but much of the humor comes from the narration. Guy Madden narrates himself, and he's sort of talking about his childhood, and he's talking about why he wants to leave Winnipeg, and he's talking about the history of Winnipeg, some of which I suspect is sort of true, but some of which I'm sure is not true, but fantastic stories.
I'm looking forward to that. If I don't see it before May, he's always a favorite at the San Francisco International Film Festival, so I'm fairly sure they'll show it.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty accessible film. You know, you don't have to know Madden's work to really appreciate it. It's certainly not as esoteric as a lot of his films. It's just kind of funny lunacy, and it's able to sustain that for most of the 80-minute running time.
Well, a few movies that I heard about through other channels that I'm not sure you saw. The one I heard the strongest reactions to is called In the City of Sylvia.
Which I haven't seen. But Darren Hughes and Gerish and several other friends of mine just were raving about it. But that's about all I can tell you, because I wasn't able to see that.
Well, also, this was a strong year for the French New Wave. It's kind of funny, these guys from the 50s and 60s who are known for their sort of very personal style of filmmaking that inspired a generation of people, even in America, are still making movies. And it's easy for a lot of us to forget that because they don't get wide distribution in this country. But this year, not one, not two, but three of those guys had movies in this festival. Eric Romare, Claude Chabrol, and Jacques Rivette. Did you see or hear about any of those?
I didn't see them. There was a lot of people who were talking about them. I mean, one of the things that it's probably obvious to some listeners, but maybe not to all, is, you know, at Toronto, we have 250 movies to choose from. It's an absolute amazing wealth of riches, of which, you know, even the most dedicated fanatic might be able to see 50 or 55. I saw 40, and that still felt like a lot. And so there's just, you make these excruciating choices sometimes that, you know, do I see the Romare or do I see, you know, the Sokurov film, that which was kind of the choice I had. I think that was the battle I had. And so I didn't see any of the three that you mentioned. The word was mostly positive on all of them, particularly the Romare. A lot of people liked a lot. It wasn't universal, but most people agreed that it was a strong step forward from The Lady and the Duke. The Rivette also had a lot of praise. And I think both of those films got picked up either at Toronto or right before Toronto as far as U.S. distribution goes.
Okay.
I know The Rivette did, because there was talk of that. I think IFC of all people. So hopefully both of those will be coming not just to film festivals, but to art house theaters, and then I'll have a chance to catch up with them. But the word on all of them was good. The Chabrol, I think, wasn't quite as strongly received. People seem to think that it was decent Chabrol, but, you know, not necessarily great.
I really liked his last movie, Comedy of Power, which I saw
in
Tribeca
too.
Last year.
I did too.
It was good. And, you know, this is also the year that Eric Romare's movie Chloe in the Afternoon was remade by none other than Chris Rock.
Yes. Did you see that film?
I did, yeah. I Think I Love My Wife was the title.
Yep.
Which
right.
was not half bad. Did you see it?
Yes, I guess that's as far as I'd go. It's not half bad.
I don't think it was a masterpiece, but I thought that was just an intriguing idea for him to try to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I wish Chris Rock wouldn't direct. I don't think he's a very good director. And particularly when he acts in his own movies, I'm not sure it always comes off as well as it could if there was a maybe a stronger director behind the camera. But anyway, that's me.
So let's kind of sum up the festival for you then.
There are three films that for me are head and shoulders above the others, in part because they may be, you know, three of the four or five best movies I see all the year. And that was, one was Roy Anderson's You the Living. One was Carlos Regadas's Silent Light, which we've talked about. And then the third one, which I think is my favorite of the three, is the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Those three films, I think, are just absolutely brilliant and real highlights of the festival. The amazing thing for me about Toronto this year was that the number of masterpieces for me outnumbered the number of bad films I saw. I think there were really only two films I saw that I disliked. One was Just Like Home. I can't remember if we talked about that earlier. Loni Scherfeg, a Danish director who did Italian for Beginners, and Wilbur Wants to Kill Himself. Her new movie, I think, is disappointing. It's trite. It panders to the audience. It's quirky characters that only have quirks about them. And then the Bangladesh film, which I saw, which is just not very good. It's not terrible. And for that matter, the Just Like Home isn't terrible either. But they're just not very good. But, you know, if you only have two films that you can say you disliked out of 40, that's a pretty amazing ratio. I saw several films that were fine or, you know, mediocre, okay. I probably saw 25 to 30 films that I could say were good to great. And so it was a great, great festival.
That's excellent, yeah.
Well, we missed you in Toronto, but I'm glad you're going to get to New York and catch up with actually a lot of the films that we were, you know, were ones we were talking about late at night in Toronto. So
great.
The general mood at the festival, I think, was, at least among people I was hanging out, was that this was the best festival in many years. And part of that is it's been a great year for film, at least, you know, the films that are being made by directors that we're excited about. And so it makes sense that Toronto would reap the benefits of that. But also that there's just people are making interesting work, and some of that work is actually getting noticed outside of cinephile circles. So it's a fun time to be, you know, watching movies and talking about movies, I think.
That's great. And a good year in Toronto typically means a good full year, a good 12 months for the rest of the country. So
yep.
Or for the rest of the continent.
That's right. And again, there's, you know, there's probably 30 to 40 films that I didn't see at Toronto that I'm excited to see, you know, assuming that a lot of those will eventually make it here to Chicago. And so that's, not only does Toronto give you a chance to see lots of great film, but you know, just the buzz and the talk and hearing what other people have seen just adds to the list of what's to look forward to.
All right, Jerry Robert. Well, thanks very much for your reports from Toronto.
Oh, they were fun, Rob. And next year, hopefully, we'll both be there, and we'll get out the old digital recorder and do it from the fast together.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you found a few good ideas in there for movies that are come into your local art house or DVD player, whatever the case may be. I hope the time warp wasn't too disorienting. In the words of Douglas Adams, it feels a little bit like being drunk. What's wrong with that? Ask a glass of water. If you have seen a good movie at a festival recently, give us a call at 415-287-4020 or send us an email, feedback@erratamag.com. That's erratamag.com. Or post a comment at www.erratamag.com/podcast, where you can also find other episodes in this series, interviews, chit-chat about movies. We'll be back next time. Bye. By the way, her name is Iris.